Chapter 19. I feigned to have it first. The younger brother, the single gentleman, the nameless actor in this little drama, stands before you now. Apostrophe, it was easy to see they had not expected this disclosure. Yes, apostrophe, I pursued. I can look back upon my part in it with a calm, half-smiling pity for myself as for some other man. But I am he, indeed. And now the chief sorrows of my life are yours. Apostrophe, I need not say what true gratification I derived from the sympathy and kindness with which this acknowledgement was received, nor how often it had risen to my lips before, nor how difficult I had found it, how impossible, when I came to those passages which touched me most, and most nearly concerned me, to sustain the character I had assumed. It is enough to say, that I replaced in the clock case the record of so many trials, sorrowfully, it is true, but with a softened sorrow which was almost pleasure, and felt that in living through the past again, and communicating to others the lesson it had helped to teach me, I had been a happier man. We lingered so long over the leaves from which I had read, that as I consigned them to their former resting place, the hand of my trusty clock pointed to 12, and there came towards us upon the wind the voice of the deep and distant bell of St. Paul's as it struck the hour of midnight. This, apostrophe, said I, returning with a manuscript I had taken at the moment from the same repository, to be open to such music, should be a tale where London's face by night is darkly seen, and where some deed of such a time as this is dimly shadowed out. Which of us here has seen the working of that great machine whose voice has just now ceased? Apostrophe, apostrophe, Mr. Pickwick had, of course, and so had Mr. Miles. Jack and my deaf friend were in the minority. I had seen it, but a few days before, and could not help telling them of the fancy I had about it. I paid my fee of 2 pence upon entering, to one of the money changers who sit within the temple, and falling, after a few turns up and down, into the quiet train of thought which such a place awakens, paced the echoing stones like some old monk whose present world lay all within its walls. As I looked afar up into the lofty dome, I could not help wondering what were his reflections whose genius reared that mighty pile, when, the last small wedge of timber fixed, the last nail driven into its home for many centuries, the clang of hammers, and the hum of busy voices gone, and the great silence whole years of noise had helped to make, reigning undisturbed around, he mused, as I did now, upon his work, and lost himself amid its vast extent. I could not quite determine whether the contemplation of it would impress him with a sense of greatness or of insignificance. But when I remembered how long a time it had taken to erect, in how short a space it might be traversed even to its remotest parts, for how brief a term he, or any of those who cared to bear his name, would live to see it, or know of its existence, I imagined him far more melancholy than proud, and looking with regret upon his labor done. With these thoughts in my mind, I began to ascend, almost unconsciously, the flight of steps leading to the several wonders of the building, and found myself before a barrier, where another money taker sat, who demanded which among them I would choose to see. There were the stone gallery, he said, and the whispering gallery, the geometrical staircase, the room of models, the clock being quite in my way, I stopped him there, and chose that site from all the rest. I groped my way into the turret which it occupies, and saw before me, in a kind of loft, what seemed to be a great old oaken press with folding doors. These being thrown back by the attendant who was sleeping when I came upon him, and looked a drowsy fellow, as though his close companionship with time had made him quite indifferent to it, disclosed a complicated crowd of wheels and chains in iron and brass, great, sturdy, rattling engines, suggestive of breaking a finger put in here or there, and grinding the bone to powder, and these were the clock. Its very pulse, if I may use the word, was like no other clock. It did not mark the flight of every moment with a gentle second stroke, as though it would check old time, and have him stay his pace in pity, but measured it with one sledgehammer beat, as if its business were to crush the seconds as they came trooping on, and remorselessly to clear a path before the day of judgment. I sat down opposite to it, and hearing its regular, and never-changing voice, that one deep constant note, uppermost amongst all the noise and clatter in the streets below, marking that, let that tumult rise or fall, go on or stop, let it be night or noon, tomorrow or today, this year or next, it still performed its functions with the same dull constancy, and regulated the progress of the life around. The fancy came upon me, that this was London's heart, and that when it should cease to beat, the city would be no more. It is night. Calm and unmoved amidst the scenes that darkness favors, the great heart of London throbs in its giant breast. Wealth and beggary, vice and virtue, guilt and innocence, repletion and the direst hunger, all treading on each other and crowding together, are gathered round it. Draw but a little circle above the clustering housetops, and you shall have within its space everything, with its opposite extreme and contradiction, close beside. Where yonder feeble light is shining, a man is but this moment dead. The taper at a few yards' distance is seen by eyes that have this instant opened on the world. There are two houses separated by but an inch or two of wall. In one, there are quiet minds at rest. In the other, a waking conscience, that one might think, would trouble the very air. In that close corner, where the roofs shrink down and cower together, as if to hide their secrets from the handsome street hard by, there are such dark crimes, such miseries and horrors, as could be hardly told in whispers. In the handsome street, there are folks asleep who have dwelt there all their lives, and have no more knowledge of these things, than if they had never been, or were transacted at the remotest limits of the world, who, if they were hinted at, would shake their heads, look wise, and frown, and say they were impossible, and out of nature, as if all great towns were not. Does not this heart of London, that nothing moves, nor stops, nor quickens, that goes on the same let what will be done, does it not express the city's character well? The day begins to break, and soon there is the hum and noise of life. Those who have spent the night on doorsteps, and cold stones crawl off to beg, they who have slept in beds come forth to their occupation too, and business is astir. The fog of sleep rolls slowly off, and London shines awake. The streets are filled with carriages and people gaily clad. The jails are full to the throat, nor have the workhouses or hospitals much room to spare. The courts of law are crowded. Taverns have their regular frequenters by this time, and every mart of traffic has its throng. Each of these places is a world, and has its own inhabitants. Each is distinct from, and almost unconscious of the existence of any other. There are some few people well-to-do, who remember to have heard it said, that numbers of men and women thousands, they think it was get up in London every day, unknowing where to lay their heads at night, and that there are quarters of the town, where misery and famine always are. They don't believe it quite, there may be some truth in it, but it is exaggerated, of course. So, each of these thousand worlds goes on, intent upon itself, until night comes again, first with its lights and pleasures, and its cheerful streets, then with its guilt and darkness. Heart of London, there is a moral in thy every stroke. As I look on at thy indomitable working, which neither death, nor press of life, nor grief, nor gladness out of doors will influence one jot, I seem to hear a voice within thee which sinks into my heart, bidding me, as I elbow my way among the crowd, have some thought for the meanest wretch that passes, and, being a man, to turn away with scorn and pride from none that bear the human shape. I am by no means sure that I might not have been tempted to enlarge upon the subject, had not the papers that lay before me on the table been a silent reproach for even this digression. I took them up again when I had got thus far, and seriously prepared to read. The handwriting was strange to me, for the manuscript had been fairly copied. as it is against our rules, in such a case, to inquire into the authorship until the reading is concluded. I could only glance at the different faces round me, in search of some expression which should betray the writer. Whoever he might be, he was prepared for this, and gave no sign for my enlightenment. I had the papers in my hand, when my deaf friend interposed with a suggestion. It has occurred to me, apostrophe he said, bearing in mind your sequel to the tale we have finished, that if such of us as have anything to relate of our own lives could interwove it with our contribution to the clock, it would be well to do so. This need be no restraint upon us, either as to time, or place, or incident, since any real passage of this kind may be surrounded by fictitious circumstances, and represented by fictitious characters. What if we make this an article of agreement among ourselves? Apostrophe apostrophe, the proposition was cordially received. But the difficulty appeared to be that here was a long story written, before we had thought of it. Unless, apostrophe said I, it should have happened, that the writer of this tale, which is not impossible for men are apt to do so when they write, has actually mingled with it something of his own endurance and experience. Apostrophe, nobody spoke, but I thought I detected in one quarter, that this was really the case. If I have no assurance to the contrary, apostrophe I added, therefore, I shall take it for granted, that he has done so, and that even these papers come within our new agreement. Everybody being mute, we hold that understanding if you please. Apostrophe, and here I was about to begin again, when Jack informed us softly, that during the progress of our last narrative, Mr. Weller's watch had adjourned its sittings from the kitchen, and regularly met outside our door, where he had no doubt that August's body would be found at the present moment. As this was for the convenience of listening to our stories, he submitted that they might be suffered to come in, and hear them more pleasantly. To this we one and all yielded a ready assent, and the party being discovered, as Jack had supposed, and invited to walk in, entered, though not without great confusion at having been detected, and were accommodated with chairs at a little distance. Then, the lamp being trimmed, the fire well stirred and burning brightly, the hearth clean swept, the curtains closely drawn, the clock wound up, we entered on our new story. It is again midnight. My fire burns cheerfully, the room is filled with my old friend's sober voice, and I am left to muse upon the story we have just now finished. It makes me smile, at such a time as this, to think if there were anyone to see me sitting in my easy chair, my gray head hanging down, my eyes bent thoughtfully upon the glowing embers, and my crutch emblem of my helplessness lying upon the hearth at my feet, how solitary I should seem. Yet though I am the sole tenant of this chimney corner, though I am childless and old, I have no sense of loneliness at this hour, but am the center of a silent group whose company I love. Thus, even age and weakness have their consolations. If I were a younger man, if I were more active, more strongly bound and tied to life, these visionary friends would shun me, or I should desire to fly from them. Being what I am, I can court their society, and delight in it, and pass whole hours in picturing to myself the shadows that perchance flock every night into this chamber, and in imagining with pleasure what kind of interest they have in the frail, feeble mortal who is its sole inhabitant. All the friends I have ever lost I find again among these visitors. I love to fancy their spirits hovering about me, feeling still some earthly kindness for their old companion, and watching his decay. He is weaker, he declines apace, he draws nearer and nearer to us, and will soon be conscious of our existence. Apostrophe, what is there to alarm me in this? It is encouragement and hope. These thoughts have never crowded on me half so fast as they have done tonight. Faces I had long forgotten have become familiar to me once again. Traits I had endeavored to recall for years have come before me in an instant. Nothing is changed but me, and even I can be my former self at will. Raising my eyes, but now to the face of my old clock, I remember, quite involuntarily, the veneration, not unmixed with a sort of childish awe, with which I used to sit and watch it as it ticked, unheeded in a dark staircase corner. I recollect looking more grave and steady when I met its moldy face, as if, having that strange kind of life within it, and being free from all excess of vulgar appetite, and warning all the house by night and day, it were a sage. How often have I listened to it as it told the beats of time, and wondered at its constancy? How often watched it slowly pointing round the dial, and, while I panted for the eagerly expected hour to come, admired, despite myself, its steadiness of purpose and lofty freedom from all human strife, impatience, and desire. I thought it cruel once. It was very hard of heart, to my mind, I remember. It was an old servant even then, and I felt as though it ought to show some sorrow, as though it wanted sympathy with us in our distress, and were a dull, heartless, mercenary creature. Ah, how soon I learned to know that in its ceaseless going on, and in its being checked or stayed by nothing, lay its greatest kindness, and the only balm for grief and wounded peace of mind. Tonight, when this tranquility and calm are on my spirits, and memory presents, so many shifting scenes before me, I take my quiet stand at will by many a fire that has been long extinguished, and mingle with the cheerful group that cluster round it. If I could be sorrowful in such a mood, I should grow sad to think what a poor blot I was upon their youth and beauty once, and now how few remain, to put me to the blush. I should grow sad to think that such among them as I sometimes meet with in my daily walks are scarcely less infirm than I, that time has brought us to a level, and that all distinctions fade and vanish as we take our trembling steps towards the grave. But memory was given us for better purposes than this, and mine is not a torment, but a source of pleasure. To muse upon the gaiety and youth I have known suggests to me glad scenes of harmless mirth, that may be passing now. From contemplating them apart, I soon become an actor in these little dramas, and humoring my fancy, lose myself among the beings it invokes. When my fire is bright and high, and a warm blush mantles in the walls and ceiling of this ancient room, when my clock makes cheerful music, like one of those chirping insects who delight in the warm hearth, and are sometimes, by a good superstition, looked upon as the harbingers of fortune and plenty to that household in whose mercies they put their humble trust, when everything is in a ruddy genial glow, and there are voices in the crackling flame, and smiles in its flashing light, other smiles and other voices congregate around me, invading, with their pleasant harmony, the silence of the time. For then a knot of youthful creatures gather round my fireside, and the room re-echoes to their merry voices. My solitary chair no longer holds its ample place before the fire, but is wheeled into a smaller corner, to leave more room for the broad circle formed about the cheerful hearth. I have sons, and daughters, and... Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.